I said, good evening.
Good evening.
Hello. Good evening and welcome to all alumni, guests, faculty, staff, students, prospective students, and everyone attending on our live stream. My name is Morgan Alexander Jones, and I'm the president of the Johnson Alumni Club of Greater New York. Thank you. The Johnson Alumni Club of Greater New York represents more than 3,500 alumni network in the world, with more than 3,000, and we're heads up to everyone to be here, by the way. Just a little heads up really quickly before I move on. Be on the lookout for the Johnson's Big Red Bash that's happening on April 30th, so that'll be a really incredible event, and our annual Women in Business event that's happening this May. And we are extremely happy to work with the Northeast Corridor office on this particular event. We're also thrilled to welcome you to this Business of Food event, which is, again, in collaboration with the SC Johnson College of Business and the Northeast Corridor office. And we want to thank our guest moderator and panelists, Andrew, Miguel, Alex, Jory, and Field. To start our program, it is my honor to introduce our moderator for this evening's event, Professor Andrew Caroli. Andrew is Professor of Finance and holder of the Harold Bierman Jr. Distinguished Professorship in Management at Cornell University's SC Johnson College of Business. He also holds an appointment as Professor of Economics at Cornell's College of Arts and Sciences. He currently serves as Deputy Dean and Dean of Academic Affairs. He joined Cornell University in 2009 after having taught 19 years at Ohio State University. You can clap for that too, it's fine. Go Bucks. Go Bucks. His research specializes in the area of investment management with a focus on the study of international financial markets. He has published extensively in journals in finance and economics, including the Journal of Finance, Journal of Financial Economics, and Review of Financial Studies, and has published several books and monographs. His newest book, Cracking the Emerging Markets Enigma, by Oxford University Press, was published in 2015. He is a past recipient of the Michael Jensen Prize for Corporate Finance and Organizations, the FAMA DFA Prize for Capital Markets and Asset Pricing, and the William F. Sharp Award for Scholarship in Finance, among many other achievements. In 2017, he was elected as a fellow of the Financial Management Association International. Andrew served as executive editor, editor of the Review of Financial Studies from 2011 to 2018, and also from 2011 to 2018, if he wasn't busy enough. He was a member of the Board of Trustees of the Financial Management Association International. He is currently president of the Western Finance Association. Andrew received his Bachelor of Arts honors in economics from McGill University and worked at the Bank of Canada for several years in their research department. He subsequently studied for his MBA and PhD degrees in finance at the Graduate School of Business at the University of Chicago. Once again, it is my very great honor on behalf of our Johnson Club of New York City to welcome our moderator, Professor Andrew Caroli.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hello, Cornell. How are you this evening? Everybody on live stream, I see the red light is on, so there literally are people watching us. This is very good news. I am so pleased and honored to welcome so many of you alumni and friends of Cornell University, as well as of the College of Business and our schools, the Dyson School of Applied Economics and Management, the Hotel School, Hotelies. There's a few. And the Johnson Graduate School of Management. There's a few in there too, and Dyson, of course. I'm here, of course, representing Kevin Halleck, our dean of our college. He and I have been traveling around the country to a number of different events, meeting with alumni, West Coast, East Coast, and one of the great things that we get to do is share our excitement about the innovation and growth in the college. We're seeing lots of enthusiasm and optimism for all that is yet to come in the college. And I just want you, through this event, whether you're affiliated with the College of Business or whether you're a friend of the College of Business through Cornell or beyond, to feel that enthusiasm and an optimism that we're feeling. Today, ladies and gentlemen, we are gathering here to showcase something called the Business of Food Initiative. You saw from my bio sketch, Morgan, I know nothing about food. I'm a finance wonk. But one of the great pleasures of this job as dean of the faculty is getting to know about all the things that are going on in the college. And one of the things that happened in the aftermath of the founding of the college was that we created these radical collaborations. We call them themes, and we seed funded them with the idea that they were community building events. There turns out to have been scholars among our midst and instructors and teaching programs devoted to food, food systems, food security, a lot of the issues that we're going to talk about today that were hidden in different pockets where these people didn't know what each other were doing. And through the college's radical collaboration effort, we brought them together. And the business of food is one of the most impressive. It is led by our distinguished Miguel Gomez as one of the co-leaders in the Dyson School, Ravinder Kingra, and also Alex Suskind is one of the founders of this theme, the Business of Food Initiative. There are almost four dozen faculty members housed among our 237 faculty members in the College of Business that have something to do with the study and teaching about food. Amazing. In fact, I asked my staff to calculate just exactly how prolific are we in terms of scholarship, thought leadership with respect to food. In the trailing three-year window, our colleagues produced 243 published peer-review articles in a trailing three-year windows. And that represents 48 different faculty members across all three schools. Now, how about them apples? I think it's absolutely amazing. And I can tell you that none of our peer business schools out there can touch that even close. Today, we're going to do something really special. And I'm going to invite my colleagues up to join us on stage. We're actually going to showcase some of the cutting edge research from two of our thought leaders in this space, okay? And also two distinguished alumni who are change agents in the industry itself. And we're going to try and have them talk to each other and share their thoughts and ideas on issues of relevance and hopefully spark some interest in you. That's our goal for tonight, okay? Are you guys ready? Yeah. Are you guys ready to get started? Everybody on live stream? Would you mind joining me? And I'll introduce you guys once you guys come on upstage. Miguel, Jory, Field, and Alex, thank you. Okay, we have ordering for our seating.
Assigned seating.
We're told we must speak into these microphones, so you guys can hear us quite well in the back. You can hear us? Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, to my immediate left is Professor Miguel Gomez. He is the Robert G. Tobin Professor of Management. He is in the Charles Dyson School of Applied Economics and Management. He is a fellow at the Cornell Atkinson Institute Center devoted to the study of sustainability. And he is, as I mentioned, the co-director of the Business of Food Initiative in the college. I should mention that Mr. Robert Tobin is sitting right over here enjoying the celebration of Miguel Gomez, who carries his name at the school. On Miguel's left is Jory Bruffett. She is a Hotelli 97. And she is currently VP of Food and Marketing at Pret-a-Manger. To Jory's immediate left is Field Failing, Arts and Science 05, MBA 12, and he is the founder and CEO of Field's Good Chicken, He's going to tell us about that. And two fields immediate left is Alex Suskind, who is a professor in the School of Hotel Administration. He is an associate dean of academic affairs in the school and also the director of that school's Food and Beverage Institute. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome your panel. Are you guys ready?
Sure.
So we actually discussed and planned out the first half of this. We've got some questions that we're going to roll through. I'm going to try and get them to react to each other as much as I can as moderator. And then there will be some remaining time at the end for questions and answers from the audience. And we have Lauren and Sarah who've got microphones, and they're going to be carrying them around. So you'll watch for those, okay? So the theme, as you probably have seen, from farm to table is really going to be a discussion in three phases where we talk about food in the supply chain. Then we're going to shift to talking about production and packaging, and then go all the way to marketing and distribution, sort of the whole value chain of farm to table. That's how we've constructed it. And the first one is really going to start with Miguel and showcase some of his research. It focuses on the supply chain and a really big issue which is related to climate, water, and sustainability issues in the supply chain. So Miguel published a couple of studies a couple of years ago that looked at, one of them looked at, for example, socially responsible products. I think the context was the coffee industry. And what he had discovered in some experiments that he ran is that consumers were willing to pay about a 52.5% price premium to pay up for products that represent some sort of expression of concern for the well-being of those who are stakeholders in the production process. This happened to be in the context of coffee and coffee sourcing. There's another study that he published recently looking at localization, locally sourced in the dairy industry. And one of the things that he studied in that is how it relates to the costs, the consequences for local sourcing and what he calls localization for incremental costing in the supply chain. That's one of the things that people worry about. So do you want to open and tell us a little bit about some of that research? And then what I'm going to ask is Jory and Field to sort of react and put their industry hats on and think about how this is relevant to them, what they think about as it relates to this. So, Miguel.
Thank you, Andrew. And briefly, coffee is very close to me because I come from a coffee farming family in Colombia. And yes, the first thing is we have done many, many studies focusing on how consumers react to what we call credence attributes of food, you know, things that you cannot prove. You have to believe, like organic, local, fair trade, Rainforest Alliance, all these certifications. And in the case of coffee and in many other commodities, and I will be short on this, but we have noticed over and over that there is a willingness of consumers to support, especially when their dollar that they spend supports producers. Yeah, more equitable share of value along the supply chain. Yeah. So yes, and that's, we see that over and over. And one of the caveats here is that even though consumers are willing to pay more at retail, sometimes we don't see that value distributed in an equal way along the supply chain between retailers, manufacturers, and growers. So that's an issue of concern.
Yeah, good. That's a good tee up. Yeah. So Jory and Field, you know, this social responsibility stuff can take many forms, right? We talked about this. It could be environmental responsibility, sustainability, social responsibility. And I guess what we want to know is how you think about some of the pressures maybe you feel from consumers or other stakeholders in your business that relates to these different dimensions of social responsibility or environmental responsibility. Jory, you want to start?
Sure. Can you hear me okay?
I think it, for us at Pred, it takes a couple of different forms. So sustainability is obviously one of our big corporate values. It has been for a long time before it was necessarily popular or important to other people, mostly because we are based, obviously, in the UK and have more of that European influence, which they have been on this journey a lot longer than the US has. And so there's a lot we can learn from them. So when we started back in 1980s, we made a decision to buy organic coffee. And so a little bit like Miguel was speaking about, we found that at that time, coffee was a commodity. So it was a way for us to have a differentiation from a marketing perspective. But as we, over the years, started to work directly with farmers in Peru, particularly, and even more recently with coffee cooperatives, it became obvious what some of the things that they've seen in the research. So not to bore you with how coffee is bought, but you pay a certain price. So you set a contract for basically a strike price for those of you who study stocks for our finance friends. Yep. But then you can pay what's called a differential. And so that differential, when you hear about fair trade, is the difference between the market price and the price you actually pay. And the idea is that that differential goes to the farmer. But it's hard to know, does that actually go to the farmer? Because if you're paying somebody in New York or whoever's buying your coffee, there's about five people in between with their hand out as well. And so we started working directly with, it's called Cafe Sanfro, but in Peru, to try and guarantee that that would come, we would get that money closer to the farmers. So that's, I think we took a more hands-on, localized approach. We've also done education where we've tried to, I guess you're a good example, is that second generation farmers or third generation said, I'm not going to stick around and do the family business because coffee prices are an all-time low, historic lows, and continue to go lower. And so it was very difficult to make a living. And so organic farming provides a way for farmers to actually have a sustainable farming practice. And so we do a year-long program where we try to educate them on the benefits of not only why, but how, and also where their coffee goes. We were talking earlier that sometimes they don't even understand that their coffee goes to America and is sold around or around the world. There's places in Africa that have thought that the coffee is going to be made to bullets, and that's not an exaggeration. So when you think about these supply chains and you're sourcing from impoverished areas, I think it's hard. So we're not having this major impact on masses amount of people, but we're trying to have a very small impact, or a big impact on a very small amount of people. Yeah. And then it, when it comes back to the consumer and all, are they willing to pay more? I think that one's a little tougher. I think what we're trying to drive is loyalty. So if people know that we're trying to be more sustainable, that we're trying to help the farmers out, are they then more loyal to our brand? And so maybe they don't, maybe we're not charging more, but maybe they'll come more often to Pred. So
repeat consumers. Great, great. Field, you want to jump in here?
I think that's
a little bit about your company that you started, and maybe that will give us some context in which you can share some of the.
Sure. So Field's Good Chicken is a fast casual restaurant based here in New York City that serves healthy grilled and roasted chicken and fresh vegetable sides. So we just opened our sixth location last Thursday. So I'm a little tired, but yeah. And so it's all grilled and roasted chicken. We don't fry anything. It is a health is a very important piece of the business, but it's an approachable health food, I like to say. Social impact and sustainability are very important pieces of the business. I think sometimes sort of early on when I was starting and I learned, I don't remember where I learned this, but that the restaurant industry in the United States is the most wasteful industry on a per square foot basis. And if you think about it, it kind of makes sense. Like, we're running equipment all day long. We have massive HVAC systems crammed into small little spaces that run all day long. We do a lot of takeout business that's all on paper. Food waste is massive. So there's such an opportunity for the restaurant business to become more sustainable and less wasteful. And I say more sustainable, not sustainable, because I think there's an important distinction in not saying we're sustainable because we do these things. Restaurants are wasteful, and there's no two ways about it. But we try to be less wasteful, and we try to find ways to reduce our carbon footprint and our impact. I think, to piggyback on what George was just saying, the way that consumers react to that, for us, we think about in terms of sort of the emotional connection with the brand. It's hard to measure, like, is someone going to pay a dollar more for a menu item because this business cares about the environment and social impact. It's hard to say. Miguel probably could study it and tell us exactly what the amount would be, but I can tell you for sure that people connect more emotionally to it. A couple things that we do. So we're members of 1% for the Planet, which means we have several menu items where 1% of sales are donated to local sustainable nonprofits. So through 1% for the Planet, we donate to Scenic Hudson, which preserves the Hudson River Valley from New York up to Poughkeepsie. And all the restaurants are wind-powered, so we pay additional money to make sure that we have renewable energy credits that offset all the electricity used by the restaurants. And the packaging program is a huge piece of sustainability. And then we also have a whole sort of sustainable enterprise piece that we're developing where we raise money for New York City Coalition for the Homeless, for something called Camp Homeward Bound every year. So what we see is there is a consumer connection to that, but also I think almost more importantly right now, an internal connection to that with our employees. In feeling like you're part of something that is doing more than just selling a product. So I think actually, like for us, I really focus on the inside out approach and how that builds sort of internal culture, internal belonging, and internal connection to this sort of overall mission.
Fantastic. Thank you, Field. So you mentioned packaging. So it turns out we got an expert sitting at the far end of the table that studies labels and packaging. And the big push here is all about clean, healthy, diet-friendly packaging. Consumers are focusing on this more than ever before, Alex. They're motivated towards products that are devoid of artificial ingredients, GMOs, pesticides. There are overt commitments. Some of the major corporations have made, General Mills, Kellogg's, Nestle, Hershey, Campbell's, to name a few. You've got a study, at least one study that I know of, you told me about, that focuses on information disclosures that relates to this. Do you want to talk about that or any of the others that you work on in terms of labeling and the consequences of labeling for behavior?
Sure, yeah. Absolutely. So I called the study that I'll talk about, it's a soccer field study. I was my oldest son and a professor of economics. Youngest son play soccer together, and we're on the soccer field watching our children play. And it was right around the time that the Affordable Care Act, some of the parts of the Affordable Care Act were getting rolled out. And you're all familiar with the restaurant labeling law, where basically you can't go into a restaurant now without seeing the calorie labels. Well, they hadn't been rolled out yet in full service restaurants. That some of the municipalities had required the labeling in like quick service restaurants like McDonald's and things like that. And we wanted to do an experiment to see if providing consumers with calorie information in full service restaurants where you sit down, where that information really wasn't being provided at the time, we wanted to see if there was an influence or an impact on that. So the great thing about the hotel school is that we have the Statler Hotel. And there's a restaurant in there, Banffy's. How many of you have eaten in Banffy's? Okay, well, yeah, okay. Right, exactly. Were any of you research subjects? Did you fill out a survey for me?
No, I didn't, no.
Okay, so we had this experiment where we wanted, and the students also run a restaurant, which is called Establishment now. And depending on when you were at the hotel school, it had many different names. It was T-Cab at one time, it was Rhapsody. At another time, it was the Ratskeller many, many years ago. So we've been running a restaurant with our students for a long time. So we set up these experiments where we table by table, we either gave consumers information, calorie information on all of the menus, or we didn't. So when the table sat, they either got all the calorie information or they didn't. And then we were able to track what they ordered, because the way our point of sale systems work is that it's by seat number. So person one sitting in seat one, we knew what they ordered. And we had them complete surveys, and we asked them questions about their perceptions of health, and did they like calorie labeling and things like that. And what we found is that consumers really actually like the information. They don't necessarily like it a lot, but they... but they like it. In other words, they like knowing kind of where that stands. And so what we were able to do because we surveyed guests in Taverna Banffy and the establishment restaurant, we had a really large range. We had over 5,000 guests that we surveyed. So this was a 2-year study that we did. Over 2 years, we collected this information. And what we found was that if we aggregated the sample, it was quite interesting, but we also found some interesting things about the students versus the non-students that might be in Taverna. So I'll tell you about the students first, just as an anecdote, then I'll talk about the aggregated study, which is probably more interesting from a policy perspective. And so students in the restaurant, believe it or not, when they had the calorie labels, they would trade an appetizer. In other words, they would give up an appetizer in favor of an alcoholic beverage. Is that a big surprise finding for all of you? Right, exactly. Surprise, surprise. Students gave up appetizers for alcohol. Okay. Rocket science at its best. And that was interesting and kind of funny in the same way. But the calories for the appetizers tended to be higher. They were, 900, 1,000 calories for these appetizers. And the beverages were about 150. The alcoholic beverages were around 150 or 200 calories, and so they were actually making these conscious choices. And we would ask them specifically, did they use the calorie information in making their decision when they had the calorie information? So that was the student thing. But all in all, what we found was when the guests had information about calories, they ordered about roughly between 5 to 7% fewer calories. In total. So that may not sound like a lot, but at the end of the day, if you think about one meal, one day of the week, if you're having fewer calories, that it's definitely going to have an impact. And my co-author of the study, or at least one of the co-authors, is an economist that studies obesity. And so the idea is that we've been able to demonstrate in a pretty controlled environment that this information does help people make better choices. They're not necessarily happy about seeing the information, but they move away from some of these higher calorie items. And we had two kinds of consumers that when we got the surveys back from them, some of them would say, well, I saw the calorie information and it really kind of annoyed me a little bit because I was just trying to have like a special meal and I was going to order the steak that had 15,000 calories, but I decided to get the chicken that only had, 800 calories. And so thank you for ruining my dinner. And so the idea is that information matters. And we've actually all been using information in making decisions in the grocery store for a very long time. And how many of you are label readers in the grocery store? Right? Okay. So everyone reads labels. So it makes sense for us to do that in restaurants as well. And in our study, we also we controlled for a lot of things, and we looked at all the nutrients and everything. And there were really no significant effects for like vitamin A versus vitamin C versus sodium. But it was actually pretty cool to do that for a couple of years. So
Jory's in charge of presumably menu development and things like that in all these prêt-à-manger stores. Yep. I think I walked past one on Fifth Ave, and I saw no alcohol options.
I had lunch there today.
But does any of this resonate for you? Do you think about these things, or how do you think about labeling issues with respect to diet-friendly type of calorie counting?
Yeah, for sure. So a couple of things. Before Pratt, I was with Panera for 10 years, right around when all this legislation was happening. And because we are national, there were places like California that kind of moved more quickly. And so we went ahead and decided to test this ourselves in advance of the national law and to see what happened, and found very similar things to your study, which is that people start making different choices when they have full transparency of what's in their food. I think a couple of things is people, and I don't know if this holds true in my life, I think it holds true in a lot of people, is you kind of are more strict in the morning, and as the day goes on, you kind of like lose your restraint. And so at breakfast, people are really looking really hard at calories, women maybe 250 or less for whatever they're eating. And then, it kind of gradually slides off during the day. And so that really helped us inform kind of our breakfast development strategy, as we knew we need to have some really low calorie things in the morning, but they still want them to taste good and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I think the other thing, though, is you talk about the effect on the consumer, but there's a dual effect on us, to your point, about how do we think about recipe development. So at Panera, we started thinking, oh God, we really don't want to put this thing on the menu that has over 1,200 calories on it. We're going to look like that's terrible. So we did a lot of work to say, okay, our kind of benchmark was we're not going to put anything on the menu that's over 1,000 calories. And so we started doing a lot of work to try to figure out how do you do that. And I think if you think about this industry, not only restaurants, but consumer packaged goods, as everybody's worked in food science, have figured out there's things that make your brain light up, and it's fat and it's sugar. So no big surprise. And then if you don't know what you're eating, you keep buying that. And so it's thinking about how do you create things that people are going to crave and want to eat but are healthy. I think with Pret, we're in a unique situation is because we make everything in batches throughout the day, it's packaged already. And so we have to therefore disclose a lot more information because of the way the law works. So you'll notice that on our tickets, we put sugar, we put other fat, saturated fat, things like that. So we are even beyond where just a Panera would be with just having to disclose calories. And we see that has a big difference. Sugar now is obviously a big pain point. It's sodium. Is another one that people will bring up. And so we're constantly, when we're looking at recipe development, at the same time we're talking about how it tastes, we're saying, well, what are the calories? And honestly, we don't want to be the place that people go and, you know, I don't know, load up on calories. We're not the indulgent place, hopefully. And we control through portion size is another way to do that. So
I want to go to Field, but you want to jump in with a quick point?
Jury mentioned the fact that the production side of things change when chefs learn a little bit more about what's in the food. And we saw the same thing at the Taverna and in the student-run restaurant, where when we were putting calories on stuff, the chef there was a vegetarian dish on the menu that people were ordering because they thought it was healthy. It was actually the second most highest calorie dish on the menu because of the cheese and the oil and all the stuff that was in there. And so when I put the calories here, like, you can't put the calories here. I'm like, no, it's my experiment. You can change the recipe if you want. But if this is the recipe you're using, we had the nutritional software. You guys probably use MenuCalc. Mm-hmm. And we analyzed all the recipes. And the chefs were actually, they were a little bit grumpy when they saw that some of their wonderful creations that they were pawning off as healthy were the worst things on the menu. And so the steak was number one because it came with French fries. And then the vegetarian dish was number two. So that's just kind of, you know.
Field, do you want to jump in here? You must have, I mean, it's a new restaurant. You didn't have the legacy of all this legislative change and forced change, but you must have been thinking about this as you launched.
Right? We're still exempt from, so we don't have calories on the menu. Although we would put them on the menu. We have them on the website in a pretty transparent way. We work with a nutritionist that we have on retainer so that all of our recipes are analyzed. And as things change, it gets updated. It's not on the menu because changing our menus is such a process that we've just been like, we don't have to do it for now. Like, let's keep things simple. But it's kind of the story you're telling. It's kind of funny. So I hired a director of culinary. He was a super talented fine dining chef a couple years ago. And there was definitely a learning curve in terms of creating menu items where I would like taste things and be like, yeah, that's great, but it tastes a little salty. Or like when we get the nutritionals back on this, like, gonna be a problem. And so I think there was definitely like some friction and a learning curve that our chef had to go through in terms of like seeing the output and the data compared to like how he'd been taught to cook, which is like chefs are taught like pinch more salt, maybe a little more sugar, pinch more salt, and then like maybe a little bit of salt for love.
And then
you end up with like 2,500 milligrams of sodium in it. Yeah. And then when you look at the numbers, it's like, whoa. So we're kind of seeing it from, I guess, a different place, which is creating recipes based on taste and like look and does this look like something I would want to eat? And then analyzing them and then going, okay, is this something that makes sense from a numerical standpoint? But it definitely factors into our thinking and has really from the get-go. And in terms of calories, we did, I think, very early on set a similar threshold, like 900 felt like a lot. This was not academic at all. We were like, yeah, 900 kind of rounds up to 1,000. So let's say no more than 900. But we were thinking that way, which is how is a consumer going
to
react?
Thinking about it. Miguel wants to jump in.
Yeah, just two comments. Bringing it to the retailing, food retailing, supermarket, what we are seeing around the world is that what is working very well is the system of colors. They're green for foods that are good for you, yellow in moderation, red, careful. And this is getting track in terms of legislation. The other aspect that I want to mention, shifting about topics a little bit, is that when we had done a lot of work with the new plant-based meat substitutes. And it, interestingly, with young people, the message that resonates is not the health message, which is definitely there are different, is the environmental message.
Yeah.
That's what they care about. So I think that this shows the balance, you know, this interrelationship between nutrition, environment, and people.
We're going to shift to one more topic, and then I want you guys to be saving your questions to bring to them. We're trying to stimulate your thinking here. The third topic, and that relates to the actual marketing and distribution of food, is about this new pressure from direct-to-consumer food e-commerce. There are industries like consumer electronics, appliances, toys, household products are already well firmly established in the e-commerce space. But according to eMarketer, in 2019, food and beverage seems to be one of the slowest industries on the uptake with respect to e-commerce, about 15% of global sales, 2019. We see Amazon moving quickly into this space. Mondelez, General Mills, Pepsi have new e-commerce divisions that they're funding well. So I guess the question I'm going to pose to Miguel and Alex right off the top here is sort of what big trends are you seeing here, or do you agree with these perceptions here about the fact that this is not taking up? And then maybe we'll shift to you guys and talk about where you're feeling this as well, this shift. So
yeah, this is a very big topic of research for us. So I will just be very brief. This is reshaping, and I'm talking about food distribution in the supermarket sector. Because yes, in the next 5 years, we are going to see a huge increase in groceries, even perishable goods delivered at home. And I think this is all the retailers are jumping into what we call omni-channel strategies, really merging the brick and mortar strategy with the online strategy. And that's not simple. There is a lot of research going on. What are the synergies between online presence and brick and mortar presence? And this, perhaps the biggest headache is for suppliers, because as a supplier, you need to be more responsive, be ready to deliver smaller sizes of batches for transportation more frequent with all the uncertainties that we have in the agricultural sector. So this is shaping, it's exciting. It's consumer-driven, but I think it's the most challenging issue for the supermarket sector.
Mm-hmm. Alex?
Well, and likewise, for the restaurant side of the business, food is perishable, and it's not. You talk about consumer goods. Well, your little iPod, you can put that in a box, and you can leave it or ship it, or it'll be fine. But broccoli or steaks or whatever else that you're trying to ship, it has a shelf life and it deteriorates very quickly. So these are things that the suppliers are wrestling with, is finding the best way to get the food to the consumers, particularly through these other channels. And they're adding a lot of restaurants are adding these, I think they call them dark restaurants. Do you
have
any? Dark kitchens where basically that there are units that are not open to the consumers except through delivery. And so basically food is produced. They find a location that's better for the distribution of the product. And that way the consumers don't go into that operation and it can service a larger area more efficiently. And so we're seeing restaurant companies and food production companies doing that to kind of meet the demand. And delivery is huge. It's just one of the largest growth vehicles for at least the prepared restaurant food side of the business. But it comes with challenges because we have all these third-party operators, and these guys will get grumpy when I mention third-party operators, because they're taking a slice of the profits in order to basically get the food to the consumers. And so you already have a low margin business and then take another 10 or 15% away from that. And there's not much left.
Phil, what do you really think about third party operators?
How many hours do we have? I think a lot of things, not all bad, not all good. I think that they've become a very necessary part of our business, and it is incremental to our bottom line. You have to fight for those dollars a lot harder, but it is becoming, I think, as we understand how to use it, a better tool. The ghost kitchens that you were just mentioning is, I think, sort of the next wave of how to utilize third-party delivery, which is, as Alex was saying, no storefronts. It's a more efficient operation. It's also a lot less rent if you put it in a basement instead of prime real estate in New York City. What we're seeing from it, so on the e-commerce topic, though, I think that the restaurant business is going through exactly the same transformation that the retail business went through. It's just 10 years behind. So, but it's going to happen on the same cadence in exactly the same way, which is the in-store experience becomes a lot more experiential, and people that are going into a store are looking for some kind of experience to interact with a human, to touch and feel a product, and then everything else is online. So delivery and ghost kitchens and everything we're probably about to talk about is sort of the manifestation of that in the restaurant business, which is like, if you want your food like that, you can order it on your phone. If you need to go taste the food or you need to talk to a human, there is a restaurant there, but there are less of them than there used to be, and they are designed for that experience. So as we just opened new restaurants, we're thinking, how do we make this a lot more experiential and then also be able to service effectively e-commerce delivery as well?
So Jory, last I checked, prêt à manger means ready to eat.
Yes.
So this is the whole reason for being for this company, right? So how do you think about this stuff?
Well, I think it's interesting because so our point of difference obviously was grab and go convenience. So we're the analog of basically order ahead, right? So that's in the 80s and 90s, you didn't have a phone. You could walk into Pret and get it faster than anybody else, and it's fresh. No, we don't have some place in Brooklyn. They're all made in kitchens and the shops. So, but as people get delivery and order ahead, it does take that advantage away from us. So, but then on the flip side, if people have an issue with, oh, your food's not made right in front of me, well, nobody's food is made right in front of them anymore. Sweetgreen's, your food is sitting out there for I don't even know how long or whenever they decided to make it. So I think the reality is there's good and bad, to your point, with all these changes. I do agree that I kind of think at some point people want a human interaction, especially at lunch. You're in places like Manhattan, I physically have to be like, slow down, like I'm just walking. And, you know, and so I think there's times where people want to figure out how to slow down. They want to have human interaction. They maybe don't want to, it's like this alone together thing. So maybe you don't want to have lunch with somebody, but you want to go sit someplace and be surrounded by other people, even if you're on your phone or whatever. And so I think having those spaces where you can go in and enjoy a meal, I mean, that's kind of the most quintessential human thing to do is sit down and share food or break bread with somebody. And I hope that's not going to go away because that's kind of fundamental to society. So I think there's a place for all these digital things, but I think at the same time, there's probably a limit. At least I hope there is.
Fantastic. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have Sarah Andrus in the back has a microphone, and Lauren Fitzpatrick has a microphone. If you have a question, please put up your hand. I guess I'll be the director here. Do you want to open? Is that what you want to do?
Okay. Yes, I've got a question from the live stream audience. We've got almost 100 people listening.
100 people, fantastic.
Yes.
Hello, everybody.
Okay, and this is from Dr. Janet Helms. She's Cal's 88 and MBA 07. And it's a two-part question. So the first one is directed towards Cornell faculty and the second one towards Jory and Field. So I am interested in food from the soil, crop, and animal production level. How has this business of food involved the College of Ag and Life Sciences, Human Ecology, and the Vet School? And the second part is I would like to hear more about the animal welfare programs at Pret and the chicken restaurant. How have you integrated animal welfare into your business model, and how have you supported animal welfare improvements at the farm level?
Okay. It's a couple of punchy questions. Go. On the cow side, I like it. Right?
That's cows.
I mean, you need to pick up the one on the soil science and the food science one.
No, this has prompted collaboration between the College of Business and CALS, definitely, and that has been one of the most exciting things for me as an applied economist. Just give you an example. We are engaged with SIPS, the School of Integrated Plant Science, on a project supported by NSF, looking at hyperlocal control environment agriculture, factory farms, vertical farms, many you see here in Manhattan, and looking at the economics, but also the environmental impacts of having hyperlocal production of vegetables. And it has been interesting. We are finding, for example, that we use much less water, but we are still too much expensive and our emissions are higher when we are so hyperlocal, unless we locate the greenhouse or the factory 100 miles away or between 50 and 100 miles away where we can gain more economies of scale. So that's a combination of, why do I bring this example? Because a combination of science based, we have at Cornell a very strong group, very, very strong, vibrant group looking at control environment and digital agriculture with the business side. So I think through the business of food, we have forged and enhanced.
You've got people coming in. Are there people in the theme that are spilling over from food science and soil science and joining some of the events?
In our theme, yes, about, I would say, one-third of the faculty involved are
from nutrition,
from CALS, from food science, and from the School of Integrated Plant Sciences.
Can you repeat the second question?
The hops growers for the beer industry are also really looking at this as well, too, with us in the business.
Can you repeat for Jory and Field the second question?
Hello?
Yep.
Okay. I would like to hear more about the animal welfare programs at Pret and the Chicken Restaurant. How have you integrated animal welfare into your business model, and how have you supported animal welfare improvements at the farm level?
So I think for us, again, being based in the UK and then bringing the business to the US, again, the practices in the UK and in Europe are far superior to where they are in the US. So we start with that as a base and do our best to try and source them here. I would say we run into difficulties with actually finding people at the same standard as what our European and UK counterparts have. So we do cage-free chicken, eggs, and then cage-free eggs. Chicken, we try to buy GAP II or humane certified. Our pork is all humane certified through Nyman Ranch. So we try to buy all our dairy milk is organic. So we try to do all these things where we can. And it's not usually a commercial decision because our standard is we try to buy high welfare things. Sometimes it's a question of supply and demand. And this is where it's tough. The bigger you get, the supply chain here is not as well set up for these things. So we're hoping to continue to influence that. We visit all our farms ourselves to try and ensure that they're doing what they should. But they have a long way to go here. You could probably talk more about chicken than I can, but even saying something like GAP II or humanely raised, it's not what you would think it would be when you go. And not a pleasant thing to talk about, but the kill step is not really what it should be. There's things called controlled atmosphere stunning that's a lot more humane than electrocution, but the standards here are just different. So there's a long way to go, and I think we just do our best by trying to source those things, but we need bigger companies to be doing the same thing to start influencing.
Field's Good Chicken is the name of the restaurant.
Yeah.
So on the on the chicken side, so we've approached animal welfare, I think, in a very straightforward way, which is just, this is our standard and we won't ever compromise. So it's antibiotic-free, humanely raised. And humanely raised, Jory mentioned it, but a global animal partnership, which is GAP, GAP level 2. And that specifies the living conditions for the chicken and the entire process that the animal goes through. So we've just said, for no reason will we ever compromise below that, and we will continue to try to improve it. But I think it's actually a fairly black and white issue for us and something that we're just, this is it. It would be very easy to pick up a number of points in our margin by going to a less humanely raised product, but then, I wouldn't want to be in that business.
Right.
But yeah, there is, as Jory says, there's a lot of opportunity. I've been out to every chicken, we've changed chicken suppliers a number of times. I've visited probably every major chicken supplier and done this half of America. And I've been to, we always visit the farms and the processing facilities and see the entire supply chain. And at the end of the day, my gut check is really just like, how do I feel about it? If it meets all of our criteria, like, do I feel okay serving this product? Everything that I've seen, is this, like, you know, does this sit well with me? That's kind of at the end of the day where it has to, you know, where I have to land. So.
Somebody from the audience. Lauren, how about in the back there? Yes.
Oh, hi.
Tell us your name.
Franco Mora, graduate in MBA 2012. So it's a two-part question. One is, how do you set up a company? So it depends on where you're a startup or more a functional company. How do you set up alignment with the equity holders of saying, yeah, I'm going to dump 10, 12, 15, whatever the number is, of your margin because we're doing ecological, sustainable things? So that's part one. And then part two is, how do you tie that with potential sales?
I think for us, globally, we make decisions on things we're going to invest in and what we believe in, and then we just plan that into our annual investments that we make. And so the food, again, we have our standards. We live by those standards, and that's just the reality of it. And then we decide to make certain investments in things like, obviously, every restaurant uses a lot of packaging. And so we're trying to move to 100% recycled content plastic. That's an investment. It's not cheaper, but as a company, we believe it's the right thing to do. So we just make it work. I mean, there's other things you have to go after. So there's things that I think you're willing to compromise on, and there are things that you aren't. And so those are the areas that we won't compromise on. And I've heard the second part of your question.
Oh, it's more...
How do you do... Oh, the sales side of it. I mean, honestly, every research study, with all respect, I've ever saw that everybody says, oh, I'll definitely pay more for that if you do X, Y, Z. In practice, I'm not so sure people do or not. So I think you have to do these things because you fundamentally believe they're important to your company and they're part of the fabric of what you want your brand to stand for. And then over time, I think you build a reputation and people, as they become loyal customers, believe in you because you stand for those things. But I think it's very hard to say, oh, we decided to sell Gap level 2 chicken, so now I'm going to charge you 40 cents more on your sandwich and think that people are really going to just jump right into that. So I think you have to be in it for the long term. It can't be a short-term marketing stunt, if you will.
Do you want to add anything?
Yeah, I think from the like startup small business side of things, it's I think in hindsight, it's very important to start with the right investor who is aligned with you on these kinds of things. If they are aligned, it's easy. If they're not aligned, it'll never work. So having someone that understands that, like, the moral fabric of the business is just as important as the profitability, and that those two, when done well, merge into great businesses. And if you're in it for the long haul, that's, you know, the best brands, best businesses are ones that have been able to marry, like, social responsibility and profitability and a good business model together without spiting one or the other. That would be my...
To Franco, in preparation for this, there was this Forbes article in early February, like about 3 weeks ago, that was actually talking about this. This is the finance guy talking, huh? Institutional investors now. There's kind of shifting winds, huh? So there's this group of institutional investors called FAIRR, F-A-I-R-R. Encourage anybody to read this, at Farm Animal Investment Risk and Return, that is actually working with corporates that are in the food space to try and compel. It's instead of worrying about the bottom line, they're actually compelling better practices, or seeking to compel better practices, or more discipline with respect to, you know, water withdrawals and things like that. So. I don't know if you sense the same thing. Maybe their investor sentiments are sort of shifting that way. Let's go to another question. Can we come to the middle here, Lauren, maybe? This lady in the fourth row here. Thank you. Introduction, please, first.
Hi, I'm Carolina Abel. Nice to meet you. I have a question with respect to how do you manage to pass on your, you know, environmentally friendly or whatever message it is to your employees. I come from a business, a coffee business, so I can relate to one of our panelists. And the difficulty that we often face is that employees tend to be, college students or college graduates who stick around for a year, for 2 years, perhaps three, but that's pushing it. And so how do you manage to help people care about the message you're trying to convey and kind of pass that on to the consumer, which is really the main goal.
Good question. Good question. You actually mentioned this field in our call. Do you want to comment on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think we talk about it internally a lot and wherever we can. It starts, so we do orientation for every new hire, and we're small enough, fortunately, now that I am the one that gives the orientation. Hopefully I'll do that for as long as I can, but sustainability is an important piece of that. And we can, a whole section of that presentation is on, this is where our packaging comes from. This is how we think about chicken sourcing. This is why we do 1% for the planet. And start from day one kind of talking about sustainability with them so that they kind of start to buy into that company ethos, and that's part of sort of the fabric of who we are as a company. And then it just needs to be repeated. So it's, with us, we bring it up with managers constantly. It's constantly talked about in our all-hands meetings. And we're always looking for ways to be more sustainable, and so it kind of creates this constant drumbeat where I think our employees realize, we're part of a company that cares about this stuff. But I think it's something that you just have to kind of constantly shout from the rooftops inside your company.
Jory, do you have any training programs that talk about these dimensions?
I mean, same. From day one, you hear about the programs. Pratt also has its own foundation. And so one of our missions is around food insecurity. And so we donate a certain percentage of products towards food insecurity in the communities we operate in. All of our food at the end of the night goes to, in New York, it goes to City Harvest, but we have a food donation partner in every city that we're in. And so I think we talk about it, and then because in our shops they're taking donations, they see that, and then they're giving, packaging the food at the end of the night, it kind of reinforces what we're talking about. So they're part of that. We do company volunteer days, and so I think it's talking about it and then giving them ways to be involved in it helps to keep perpetuating the culture of it.
Miguel, one of the things you do is you run something called the Food Industry Management Program. You train a lot of executives in this space. Do you know if this comes up ever, talking about getting inside the head of your employees and how they think about the practices? Does that come up in any of the discussions?
Yes, definitely. The message and the actual actions of companies towards being more sustainable, to creating a culture of sustainability, is definitely is that important that in our this year in our executive programs we include one complete session on that we call food system sustainability. And when you go to those sessions, you can almost not speak because all the executives are sharing experiences, the challenges. So I think it's definitely in the mind of every leader in the industry, and there is not a clear answer.
Alex, thought? Anything?
Well, it's culture. You have to build the culture of your organization, and it's not just words on paper. You have to do the things every day. That if you talk about sustainability and you don't do it, and you don't embrace it, then your employees will never do that. So right. It's really just about doing what you say you're going to do,
right,
and finding the things that matter. And you also have to hire the right people.
Right.
If you don't get the right people to work with you, they'll never be able to achieve the things that you want them to. So that's really what it comes
Where's
down
Lauren?
To.
Lauren? Can we go over to this side of the room, Lauren? Fair is fair, right? So maybe over in the far side over there. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Isha Saini. I'm with Danone North America. I have a question about the certifications that I think you guys had all referenced separately earlier on. So I know there's a lot of skepticism in the food industry. There are a lot of third-party certifications out there, but many times I think people think that the word organic means the same thing as natural, for example. And one of those is defined by legislation and one of them isn't. For most FDA-regulated products. So I'm just curious how you deal with consumer understanding. It's great to have a lot of certifications, but how do you explain what that means ultimately to the consumer in an effective way that's also trustworthy? Because I know there's also a lot of food industry lawsuits that I'm sure the lawyers in the room are aware of as well.
There are a few, right? Do you want to, I think that's those are directed to you guys. Do you want to take that on?
Yeah.
Certifications, legal, regulatory.
Yeah.
It's a lot. I mean, honestly, it's difficult to navigate. I think what we're seeing is, I think there's a very miseducated consumer out there because of these kinds of things. One of the, I think an example that still that drives me a little bit crazy is the distinction between like what is free-range chicken is a door that's like this big so that they have access to the outdoors at least, I think, 12 hours a day or something like that. And then, so that's it. And then I go out to these chicken farms and you see all the chicken inside because it's warmer inside. And so all the doors are open and consumers are paying extra and being sold this, basically this marketing message, like free-range chicken, and the chickens aren't free-ranging. And then you go to a barn that's literally on the same farm that
don't
is
make
the,
me free-range.
The non-free-range. Yeah, and you're like, why? Yeah, like, why is this? Like, well, if they go outside, like, hawk might eat them. Like, there are like very good reasons why they're not free-ranging. It's crazy. But it has been packaged very neatly into a marketing message. So I think in terms of like on the lawsuit side, we just try to stay super transparent and like what it is we say what it is. We try not to hang our hat too much on those kinds of things too. And we try to focus more on just like sourcing really good quality ingredients and creating food that we're proud of, and less on like food that we can list like, well, it's this and it's this and it's this and it's this. But I think what you bring up is a major challenge in the industry right now, which is educating the consumer on what their food actually is and stripping away kind of all the BS.
Should we go up for another question on live stream? Here, is there another one you got handy? Just want to make sure they're not forgotten.
Yes, of course. So this is from Jonathan Packman, Hotel School MMH99, and he says, hi, Alex.
Hi, Jonathan.
Wherever you are.
This question is from
Miguel. Ask him where he is right now.
Where are you, Jonathan? I'll tell you in a second if he answers. What is the value, this is for Miguel, what is the value of local to consumers and how much are consumers willing to pay a premium for locally grown food in grocery stores and in restaurants?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So building on what my colleagues just answered, you know, there is so much confusion of what is local. Some people think it's organic, is it family farm grown, is it 30 miles, 100 miles in the same country? There is a whole range, and you ask, have done research asking consumers, and means different things for different people. Some consumers think that, you know, we have local coffee, and the coffee is coming from Africa, but there is a local coffee roaster that goes and buys it, and it's a local business, so it's all over the place. However, what I have to say about local is an important attribute. We care. And I would say all the research that we have done, we have learned that if you are a local product, you have an advantage if you are different. No, let me give you an example, apples, you know, New York State apples. You know, if you produce heirloom varieties, very, very traditional varieties, that's a local variety that will always get a premium. At the consumer side, and again, this is true when you ask consumers in hypothetical situations, so they tell you they pay between 10 to 15% premium. The supermarket is less, but they will prefer the local product than the other products, everything else equal. So there is a little bit of a premium willingness to buy from consumer. But what, at least in the supermarket sector, we see that there is very little willingness to pay price premium from the buyer to the grower, except when you are a natural food store. And I suspect in the restaurant industry, there is a little bit more flexibility and the local, because you are selling a product that is much more differentiated, restaurants. So there is more possibility of getting a price premium for the grower in terms of local. We see that in the hyper-local microgreens produced here in New York City, produced very close to here or in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm. Anybody want to add anything?
I just think it's tough. I think consumers want to buy local, but the reality is they also want to eat lettuce year-round. So in the summer, you can get lettuce from the North Fork of Long Island, and it's beautiful and great. But if you want to eat a salad in the winter, it's coming from Yuma, Arizona, or Salinas at a different time of the year. So I think, you know, if we want to really be local, then we have to look at our own eating habits and, you know, go back to canning and pickling, and I don't know. That's not going to happen. And I think the other thing is back to the marketing point somebody made. You have to be careful about when people say marketing, when you look or local, you look into it and they might be a 250, 500, you know, mile radius. So, yeah, I don't know. I think that's a pretty abused term.
Please, right here, Lauren, can we?
Jonathan would also like you to know that he's in Berkeley.
He's in Berkeley.
Oh, Berkeley.
Okay.
I'm a nutritionist, and to add to what you both said, New York City has farmers markets during the mild months in low-income communities as well as high. They are more expensive. People bring their EBT cards, and they buy more expensive produce because it is local and fresher. And if it's fresher, it's more nutritious. My question is about the delivery, combining brick and mortar and home delivery. And one of the hallmarks, well, first of all, the shopping determines the cooking, which determines the health of the eating public. And the and since the 20th century into the 21st, unreliability is the name of the game in produce in the supermarkets. It can be advertised, but it might not have come in, and it might not come in as pictured, as envisioned. Mm-hmm. And so there has to be a substitution. How will these ghost kitchens and this delivery address the unreliability of the supply chain?
Very good.
So I think what's happening is there's a really interesting sort of revolution happening with the food supply chain right now that is really just at the very forefront, but the entire supply chain is getting sort of squished like this. And so if you start from the very beginning, imagine you have vertical farms where produce is actually grown indoors in cities and harvested by automated equipment, and it can be grown in a very controlled environment and can be harvested fresh like every day, and it's literally in the city in a building, so then it can be sent directly to the farmer's market, or it can be sent to a restaurant or to a ghost kitchen that's right down the street, and then the food can be prepared there, and ultimately it can then be delivered by drone when that comes, which is probably not that far away, to someone's house in the suburbs or here in New York City, and you actually take the miles between the product, which is where freshness really evaporates, and you end up bringing the food very close to the consumer. So the whole food supply chain, I think, is going to change pretty dramatically over the next several years, and it will result in fresher food being available to many, many more people, and then ultimately that will also start to drop the price on fresh food and produce, too. We've got a few years before that happens. Will it be adequate to feed 8.5 million people? I hope so. I mean, I think the whole food supply chain has a very long ways to go and is very, very, very complicated for a number of reasons, not just the supply chain itself, but the way the government is involved. So we have a long ways to go. But it will definitely, I think, improve food accessibility significantly.
Got time for maybe a couple more here. Can you come up to the front here?
Yeah,
Hold on, wait for the microphone. Because we want everybody on live stream to hear.
I'm a guest. I'm a parent of a Cornell student. Lots of talk about supply chains. But can you give me kind of a rule of thumb? And I realize it varies a lot. But you have a basket of blueberries that sells for a buck at the grocery store. How does that dollar get allocated by the different people in the supply chain?
So I do research on that. So I will take. So that dollar that you spend in blueberries.
Wondered why we picked
approximately
you.
15 cents go to the grower. Yeah. A supermarket, if it is integrated, self-distributing supermarket with a distribution center, about half of the value, 50 cents, stays there. Transportation is about 13. And other intermediaries are the balance. So only 15 cents to the grower. Not that they are being, so what is growing is that is the value that you pay for the service of convenience, of bringing the product, of packaging, of everything that is going on. Not that the grower is getting less money for the pound of blueberries. It's because the other aspects beyond the farm gate is where 85% of the value is being created. Yeah.
Let's take one more. How about in the back? Thank you all for your questions. I'm sorry we can't take them all. Right in the back, right there. Yeah, thank you.
Hi, I'm Morgan.
Introduce yourself, yeah.
I'm Morgan. I graduated 2016 from College of Arts and Sciences. I'm wondering if you guys can speak a little bit to the trend of alternative proteins and how you see that with respect to building out your menus, and if that's something, if at all, that you're considering, you know, with growing animal welfare concerns, sustainability, public health crises, that type of thing. Especially with a company with chicken in the title, I imagine it's probably pretty tough if you're going to move towards like a plant-based menu offering or cultivated chicken or that type of thing. But thoughts on that?
So I think it goes beyond the alternative proteins, which I think are great, but it's just, I think, more about encouraging people to eat more vegetarian and vegan when they can. So we focus a lot on how do we, with every kind of menu relaunch, how can we create more vegetarian items, more vegan items, plant-based milk. We took the charge away. If we don't charge for that, I think we're one of the only people, because they're trying to say, look, it's better. Why are we singling you out? So I think the whole plant-based meat thing is great, because I think it gets people who wouldn't just eat straight vegetarian maybe over the line and into that habit. But from a sustainability standpoint, we should all be trying to eat, and your own health, eat less meat. It's one of the best things we can do. So we have a sub-brand in the UK called Veggie Pret. So I'm hopeful that we'll have one here. We're trying to build up our vegetarian base to try and hopefully get there. So I think we're going to all have to think about that. So I think it's great. It gets people in the boat, so to speak.
Yeah, I'm all for it. I mean, I'm waiting for a great chicken alternative, which doesn't exist yet. So when Impossible Chicken comes out, we'll be starting R&D very quickly. But we also, I mean, vegetables are a very important part of our menu. It's something that like Jory's saying, we have added and added and added, and we're always sort of central to the concept. So we have a great vegetarian plate. I actually think you can eat vegetarian and vegan better at our restaurant than many restaurants in New York City. So we cater to both, and I think I'm in favor of the plant-based meat alternatives for exactly that reason. If they get people over, they open up doors to people, I think that's great. So they will have a place on our menu once it fits chicken.
Okay. Well, I learned a ton. I don't know about you guys. We have... first of all, I'd like to say, and maybe ask all of you to join me in saying a special thank you to my colleagues, Miguel, Alex. We are really proud to have you in the college leading the charge on this super important topic. Look at all the people you brought out tonight and online. Thank you. Jory Field, you make us proud. Continued success. Small token of our appreciation for coming and participating. And
thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'll just jump down here. And I want to say on behalf of, and maybe if you don't mind joining with me also to thank the people that were behind the scenes, Lauren Fitzpatrick, Sarah Andrus, that did all the work to really make this happen. To everybody online and all those of you who took your evening to be with us, you know, hopefully Cornell is making you proud. And come back to the next event. Thank you.
Excellent.
Congrats.